peace is the goal. Living in peace is not, it's the basic idea of Judaism, in my opinion.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guest today is, first of all, a friend. he's an Israeli-American educator, researcher at Harvard Kennedy School, and expert on U.S.-Israel relations. Here I am with Barak Sela.
Great to be here. Thank you, Shai.
I am so glad we made this work. People need to know that.
Yeah.
I found out you're in the city yesterday.
Yes.
I said, hey, can you make it? You pushed your flight a couple of hours to make it.
You know, whatever I can do to spend more time with you, you know?
I love that, man. I have so many things to talk about because you've done so many things. So I'll just jump right to the first question.
Yeah.
Barak Sela, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, that's a big question. I am a very Jewy Jew. I'm not religious, even though in recent years I think I've become closer to religion or to spaces of religion. But I'm not religious. I come from a, you know, Israeli household. I grew up in the States, but both of my parents are Israelis. So we always spoke Hebrew at home and celebrated the holidays. And, you know, even growing up in America was a name like Barak before it was cool. You know, it was obviously that I'm Jewish, Israeli. But I think more than anything, I'm a Jew that is connected to my history. What makes me more than anything a Jew, I would say, are my grandparents and sort of their stories and where they came from. Because the things that they went through because of their identity, their Judaism, is what brought me to where I am today. And they're not, by the way, I would say big Jews. They were not religious Jews. They were assimilated Jews in Europe. But sort of the reality and the circumstances and the choices that they made that allowed me to be who I am today is something I really respect. So everything I do in my Judaism, for me, even the tattoos that cover my body are dedicated to my grandparents because those are my roots. And I think no one, especially a Jew, cannot lead anything, cannot do anything if they don't know where they came from. That's the most important thing a leader needs, any person needs, and especially a Jew needs.
Right. So knowing where you come from
and
I want to give the audience a chance to understand where you come from.
Yeah.
So you were born in Texas.
Yes, Houston, Texas.
To Israeli parents. Why were your parents in the U.S.?
My dad's an oncologist, a doctor. And in the 80s, you know, he had a dream of working in one of the best hospitals in the world. And a very classic Israeli immigrant story. Went for 2 years, ended up staying 12. And so they lived there. And, you know, and we were very involved in the Jewish community. Even then, there were a lot of Israelis living in Houston, Texas. And I was born there, grew up, went to, you know, Jewish day school, went to a Jewish summer camp. And when I was around like 9 and a half, at the end of 1994, my parents finally decided to go back to Israel.
Right. And while you were in the U.S., you were involved, I read, in both the Tzofim, the Israeli scouts.
No, not the Tzofim.
No, not the Tzofim?
No. Oh, okay. In the U.S., I was in Young Judea.
I see.
No, when I moved to Israel, I went to Anor Oved, which is the more, you know, center-left, more socialist Zionist brand of youth movements. Very sensitive in Israel to confuse
them. I wanted to prod. And, as someone who grew up in Anor Oved, I was
wanted to prod.
So you grew up in Israel, in the Nor Oved, which how do you describe the Nor Oved? Like, how do you translate it?
And well, the direct translation is the working and learning youth. But basically, it's the youth organization or youth movement that's sort of affiliated with the kibbutz movement, with the labor party, with the labor union, sort of with the traditional labor movement of Israel, center left, I would say.
Right.
But it's important to note that youth movements in Israel are a very central part of like childhood and society.
Or at least they used to be.
Well, right. I think there still are in many ways. Definitely when you and I were growing up, about a third of Israeli kids go to these youth movements who some of them are less political, like Hatzofim, but some are very political. And they're a place where you know, if you go to school to learn math and English and science, you go to the youth movement to learn leadership, values, identity, to be part of a group. And I found my identity. I laughed at like Hanor Oved, my youth movement, was like my Misrad Klita. It was like my absorption center that taught me what it is to be Israeli. Like as a kid who was born in Texas, who missed the first 10 years of Israel. That's where I learned, you know, that was my socialization process.
Right. And many people, you know, most kids leave it like when I was about ninth grade, I think that's when I left the Novoved.
Yeah.
Others leave it when they graduate high school, 12th grade.
Yeah.
Others do an extra year.
Yeah.
Others go to the Nahal, which is part of the military.
Yeah.
You kept going.
I kept going.
And you made it all the way to the spokesperson
yes.
of the movement.
Yeah.
Now, give people a sense of how big this movement is.
So it's pretty big. It's one of the largest in Israel. It's about 100,000 members in over 400 clubs all over Israel. Very diverse. So, you know, from all different socioeconomic backgrounds. It's one of the only youth movements in Israel that is Arab and Jewish. So they have about 20,000 Arab members, also part of this youth organization.
One of them was a featured guest here, Tamer Masoud.
Yes.
Who was a big member.
Yes, I know him personally, and he's an amazing person, yes. Yeah. And I did a big article with him when I was spokesperson. So yes, Tamer from the Arab youth clubs. And it's something that I chose to be part of because, you know, I moved to Israel. One of the reasons that my parents moved to Israel was because Rabin was, you know, prime minister at the time. And there was a lot of optimism and sense of normalization and peace is around the corner. And they were like, this is a good time for us to go back to Israel because...
How wrong were they?
Well, you know, yeah. Were they wrong? I don't know. You know.
Yeah, I don't know.
And Hanor Ovid, which is, by the way, the youth movement that also Yitzhak Rabin grew up in, was just close to my house. And I just remember that I, for the first time, felt really at home. Because growing up as an Israeli in Texas, and you know that your parents are from another place, and I also grew up knowing that we're always leaving eventually. Mm-hmm. Like, don't get too used to this place because this is not your home. And finally, I found a place that I was at home and you know, that we all speak the same language. And I think most importantly, I felt a place that I can make an impact, that I can do something good, I can affect people, I can lead something. Right. And, you know, in a post Yitzhak Rabin assassination Israel, which is the Israel that I basically started my journey in, being part of a youth movement and being involved politically was the obvious choice for me.
Right. So, and part of being a spokesperson, you oversaw some really impactful projects. Yeah. I read a little bit about them. I was hoping you could tell me more.
Yeah.
The 1 million kids.
Yes.
What was that project?
That was when I was spokesperson. I think we were preparing for one of the elections. And we were really thinking, what is the role of a huge youth movement in a general election in Israel? And maybe back in the day, youth movements, the political ones, were very tied to specific political parties. But Israel has changed, and our movement has become much more diverse. And it wasn't just about, oh, you know, we're going with this or that party and just supporting the candidate. What is the real impact that teens who cannot vote, but how can they affect the election? And at the time, poverty was a big issue, you know, on the headlines, and it's still a very important issue in Israel. You know, we don't talk about it. We don't talk about the financial realities in Israel and how, you know, critical they are. And there just came out a big report about child poverty and hunger with kids. And we were like, there's potentially up to 1 million kids who are in some kind of risk of poverty. And who is it more than the teens to give voice to those 1 million kids? And so the role of this campaign was to basically amass, you know, huge amount of signatures from teens all over Israel. And whatever the elections may be, to come to our politicians and say, this is the agenda. We want you to put this on the agenda because we may not be able to vote now, but we will be able to vote in 2-3 years. And we're looking. So the whole issue was, how do you give kids who are, you know, are counted out, these 14, 15, 16-year-olds, but they're going to be voting adults soon, but even as teenagers, they have opinions, they have a voice. So the whole idea was to give them voice and help them put something on the political agenda.
Right. I think something that Americans might not realize, Canadians and people outside of Israel may not realize, that in Israel, when you turn 18, you're able to vote.
Yeah.
You're able to drink. And you go to the military.
And you go to the military.
And
get a lot of responsibility.
It's like you get all the responsibilities together. And that's why I think teens are more counted in Israel, because they are really treated as not the far future, but the near future.
And that's why these youth movements are so important, because you get all that responsibility at 18. You got to prepare and you got to build some character and some leadership identity to be really able to deal with those challenges in the best way possible.
Right. There was another project that you worked on that I thought was just beautifully named, and the goal was amazing, and I want to hear more about it. Mivtza Chom Enoshi, Operation Human Warmth.
Yes. Operation Human Warmth. So this was, it's very interesting how this happened. So we were actually doing a protest in front of an embassy in Israel. I think it was maybe the Chinese embassy we were protesting. And one of a woman called Gal Lusky, she's the CEO of an amazing humanitarian aid organization called Israeli Flying Aid, who's also an alumnus from Hanor Oved. And she reached out to us and she was like, listen, I grew up in your youth movement. I appreciate you. I see sort of your strength and your presence. I want to do a humanitarian aid mission for Syrians during the Syrian Civil War. So this is just after the Syrian Civil War sort of broke out.
So we're talking about like 2012?
Yeah, 2012. And it was winter. And there was a harsh winter in Syria. And, you know, we sort of don't remember that up until the Civil War, people in Syria were living a regular life, more or less. They lived in houses, they went to buy their food in the supermarket, and suddenly people were displaced, people were living in tents, people were starving, and you know, this terrible war where, you know, hundreds of thousands were killed right across our border. And there was nothing that we could do in Israel. That's what we thought. And she came to us and said, we want to do something. We want to help. And I was like, yeah, but what can we do? And so we came up with the idea, can we, you know, raise humanitarian aid for the Syrian people, you know, blankets, sleeping bags, sweaters, to make sure that they can go through this winter, because it was really difficult to get the aid into Syria.
But can I ask you why? I know it's a lot of people would be like, why not?
Yeah.
Right. But you don't see Syrian youth doing the same for Israelis. You don't see Jordanian youth, Egyptian youth. We're surrounded by countries that if the people don't hate us, then many are just indifferent to us. And then why mobilize Jewish and Arab Israeli youth for Syrians?
Well, I think you have to understand, it comes to, I think, understanding something very deep in Jewish identity, in my opinion, also in Israeli identity. The youth movement I grew up in, our motto is La'avodah, la'ganah, ve'la'shalom, which means for labor, that's the sort of socialist part, for defense, and for peace. So as an Israeli, I think the way you need to grow up is, yes, I'm willing to do anything that is needed to defend myself, my people, my homeland. But peace is the goal. Living in peace is not, it's the basic idea of Judaism, in my opinion. So, and, you know, we were talking about Rabin. He said, peace you do with your enemies. And if we have an opportunity to, and this is not our war, the civil war in Syria.
Right.
This was not our war. This was a tragic, terrible war, which whatever, you know, perspective you had on it, hundreds of thousands of people were dying. And I think it's just basic humanity. That's why we called it Operation Human Warmth, not only because we were, you know, providing blankets and sleeping bags. And so what we did is we were very scared, because this was the first time there was any type of humanitarian aid drive by the civilian population in Israel for what is designated a enemy state. And so we were pretty stressed out, like, how would Israeli public respond? Would they like say, oh, you guys are traitors? Oh, this is a, why are you helping Syrians when you have poor people in Israel? And so we really like made a very good media plan, and we designated about 15 clubs around Israel to be sort of distribution and collection centers. The interesting thing is, how did we even get it to Syria? So it was a collaboration with the IDF. So this later became public knowledge. At the time, it was top secret. In all the interviews, I could not share the information about how we were passing. But the IDF set up a special unit called Shechenut Tova, which means good neighbors, which was providing humanitarian assistance to Syria. So we collected the aid.
Wait, I want you to take a moment.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, like you and I, we take things like that for granted.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think a lot of people would understand this. The mm-hmm. IDF, which is Israel's defense yeah. force, the military, was providing or helping provide mm-hmm. humanitarian aid to Syria, a war that they have nothing to do with.
Yeah.
You don't typically see that,
yeah.
especially with quote-unquote enemy countries in mm-hmm. other countries. So that's an incredible point.
So I think that there's two things to know about why would the IDF do something like that. So first of all, look, most Syrians have obviously never met an Israeli in their life. Most Syrians have also not gone to war with Israel. Like the last war with Syria was in 1973. They only know stories about Israel. They only hear usually not good things either in their schools or on TV about Israel, but they don't know Israel. So first of all, obviously the IDF would have an interest to provide this aid, even from a cold like interest, you know, of if they get a better experience from Israel and they understand, oh, they're not the, you know, the terrible people we've heard, that is better for us because it's better for us to have a population that sympathizes with Israel than just has animosity. Right. And I think so there's also a cold interest. But on the other side, yes, there's also a value here. There's a value of, and by the way, Israel has consistently done this over the year, sending aid missions to countries all over the world, being the first to get, you know, send a delegation to help. And not enough people give credit to Israel about this, and this is something pretty amazing. And if it's the IDF or it's the humanitarian organizations, I think it's something that is just second nature. And I have to say, again, I was very worried about the response of the public. The response was amazing. People totally got it. You know, we didn't get any hate. People really understood the idea of, yes, it makes sense for young Israeli Jewish and Arab teens to go to their parents, get the old sleeping bag, get the old blankets. And by the way, we had to take off all the Hebrew tags off the, mm-hmm. like everything we collected, because when we passed it on, we didn't want the Syrians to know that it came from Israel.
You didn't want to endanger them.
Exactly. And it wasn't important.
Which, by the way, is an interesting thing in the Middle East, right?
Yeah.
Like, even when you help, you want to take away the Israeli tag, because if someone found out you have an yeah. Israeli blanket, you might get in trouble.
Yeah, but that's, you yeah. know, we have to be realistic about yeah. the reality we live in, right. you know?
So you were you're a former spokesperson for the Nor Oved.
Yeah.
Then you became the executive director of Reut Institute.
Yes.
Which is a think tank. What does it focus on?
It's a leadership and strategy think tank in Israel, but also it has an offices here in New York. And what the Reut Institute was doing was, it was founded about 20 years ago by Gidi Greenstein. And the idea of Reut was to help leadership and decision makers close the gap between sort of their existing mindset and adapting and new challenges. So let's say, you know, you have a challenge. Let's say that challenge is terrorism or anti-Semitism or anything, and you figure out the challenge and then you build a mindset to deal with that challenge. The problem is we create mindsets. At a certain point, you know, our mindset is going one way, but the challenge is already going a different way, and there's a gap. And it's really hard to convince people to adapt new mindsets. And I think you would, you know that more than anyone. So the whole role of Reut, which means vision, was to identify those instances where there was a gap between how we think about things and where reality actually is, and help create new frameworks for leaders to deal with those challenges. Most of what I did was Israel-World Jewry relations. That was the most central part of my focus. Because we saw that Israeli society was not really thinking properly about world Jews and giving them the respect and value that they have and the purpose that they have as part of Israel. But I also did a lot of work on Abraham Accords, global anti-Semitism, radical movements, what we call the Red-Green Alliance, Israel-US relations, of course. So it was very interesting, and I had the opportunity to really work on a lot of different issues.
Right. And one of those gaps you mentioned was in 2021.
Yeah.
So 2 years before things really erupted in the U.S., the Reut Institute came out with a project or a paper called the Red-Green Alliance.
Basically.
Exactly. Outlining, before most people even noticed, the relationship between extremist movements like Hamas mm-hmm. and academic socialist circles.
Yeah.
And you told me once that when you came to the US to give talks about this, and you came to close the mindset, right? Like to shift, to close the difference between the mindset and the problem.
Yeah.
Nobody was willing to listen, or very few people were convinced.
Yeah, it's I talk about this a lot, how this is maybe sort of the most successful failure. This report, which is called the Red-Green Alliance, and let's say, what is the Red-Green Alliance? It's this sort of unholy connection or alliance between the green, which is the extremist Islamist organizations, and the red, which is sort of the radical elements of the progressive movement. And why are these two elements working together? Why are Islamists who are against LGBTQ people, who are against women's rights, who are against equality, sort of finding an alliance with radical parts of the progressive movement who are supposedly really supporting the exact opposite? And how is this coming, and why is it a threat to us Jews? And we put out this paper, this was led by Eran Shashon, my CEO at the time. And our whole idea was, we're seeing this happening in Europe. We're seeing it growing in the US. This is becoming a real threat to the Jewish community and to America. At the time, this was Trump won, so Trump was in power. And people's mindsets were, and not for being wrong, right? They were focused on anti-Semitism from the right. This is the year of Tree of Life, you know, Pittsburgh. Jews will not replace us, Charlottesville. People were very rightfully concerned from anti-Semitism from the far right. And we basically said, listen, this paradigm, left, right, okay, most Jews did not vote for Trump, and you're very worried about Trump, but there's another thing happening here that's not connected to if I support or don't support the current administration. And we met with a lot of Jewish leaders, and you know, some people realized what we said. Some people pushed back and said, you know, you guys are exaggerating. It's just some like college students, and you know, it's on the fringe. It doesn't really.
And this is just 2 years before everything erupts.
And also some people, I would say, and this is something that I heard, saw what we were saying and were like, yeah, Barak, we can't really work on this, because even if you're right, everything you're saying, it's just playing into the power of the right, because the right is just going to use this as like, oh, here's all this anti-Semitism on the left. And, you know, at the end, we need to choose which side we're on. And so even if sort of we agree with what you're saying, there's not a lot we can do without playing into the right. And I just think that people did not really see this as something critical enough. And unfortunately, and I say this as someone who really grew up sort of in leftist movements, I think people didn't see this as a leftist cause, because we were saying, guys, there's anti-Semitism, there's something growing on the left that is concerning. And this is actually taking away what it really means to be on the left side of politics.
Right. It, in a way, if there's a problem on the left and you consider yourself on the left, then it's your problem. If there's a problem on the right and you consider yourself on the right, it's your problem. Like, you don't walk around the world talking about the problems your neighbors have.
Exactly.
You talk about your problems, and yet here, logic breaks down.
Yeah, but I think, you know, there's so many reasons, I think, why it was hard for the Jewish community to deal with this. You know, one of the biggest things that I always think about regarding October 7th, we talked a lot about the conceptia, the conception, the frameworks that failed in Israel, right? That allowed Hamas to conduct that, you know, terrible attack. We don't talk enough about the failed conceptions or frameworks in the American Jewish community, who was also very surprised, in a way, from the waves of anti-Semitism that both you and I encountered on campuses. Obviously, the Jewish community was not prepared. Obviously, if the IDF was not prepared for what happened on October 7th, you know, on the border, the Jewish community was not prepared for what happened on campuses on October 7th. And there's so many reasons, you know, there's financial reasons, there's like rigid communal structures, leaders who are not adapting, a generational gap, you know, between the older parents and their kids who are going in a different direction. So many reasons, and there's always systematic reasons. The reason that there's so many reasons doesn't mean we don't do repair, don't do tikkun. It's something that we still can do. And I am starting to see it in the Jewish community, not as much as I would want to, but it's definitely getting there. But, you know, boy, did we get, you know, smacked in the face, and we could have maybe been more prepared.
You know, of course, you can't characterize everyone because everyone is different. But in general, do you think it's because, and I count myself amongst those people that, although we haven't met in 2021, I may have been skeptic if I've been given the report in 2021. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's because many of us were unable to see, or did we just not want to see and we focused on other stuff because we didn't want to see what was happening?
I think it's much more basic than that. And this is something we talked a lot when I was at Reut. When you have a system that's not aligned to a challenge, the people who are the last to figure it out are the people in the center of the system. When you're inside a framework, it's really hard to rethink about it because we fall in love with our own ideas. And also you can't change everything every time the wind blows in a different direction. It would be very, very irresponsible. And we, you know, we build institutions, people have salaries, they have jobs. You can't just say, oh, let's shut this organization down, build a new one because we feel the reality is changing. But that's why you need people from the outside. Our advantage was that we were doing this research from Israel, and we were actually looking from the outside in, and we were seeing a lot of things that actually were much harder for people who are on the ground on campus in many ways to see, either because they were caught in the existing frameworks or they were too busy dealing with day-to-day things. They didn't have the time and resources to like, wait, let's look at the root cause. Let's think about this. That's why we always need people to be able to be open to people from the outside, because usually the people from the inside, like in many things in life, are the last to figure it out.
Right. But then just a month before October 7th, 2023, you, in a way, transitioned from the outside to the inside.
Yes, exactly.
You described it to me as, I wanted to leave my job and start something new and take a distance from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And, and you came to the least conflictual places in the world, Harvard University.
Yeah.
Then October 7th happens. Mm-hmm. Do you remember where you were?
Oh, I remember it. Like, you know, I came to Harvard in the summer of 2023. I had a few great months. It was beautiful. You know, it was like a nerd vacation. I was just studying, hanging out with people, you know, fulfilling this like dream of just like going to Harvard and getting this amazing education. And yeah, I remember it was 11:39. I'm a night owl, so I was awake in my apartment in Cambridge. And I started getting, you know, push notifications. The difference here is that everyone in Israel was still awake, asleep, and it take time for them to get up. I was wide awake. I was watching Netflix or something. And the notifications on Ynet didn't really make sense to me. So I immediately went to Telegram because I was already connected to like all these extremist like Telegram groups because of my research. And I text my friends. I think 15, 20 minutes after, I wrote to my best friend who was like, oh, this is just another round of missiles, like, this is war. I wrote him, we are in war. And I figured that out when I saw the first truck, like, in Sderot.
Yeah.
Didn't sleep all night. The day after, you know, I went to visit my girlfriend in New York and was just crying for 24 hours and in shock. And, you know, I used to live in the Gaza border. I worked there in education for 4 years. I know many people whose family members were kidnapped. I know people who were killed that day. People who were, you know, besieged for 24 hours, like people, close friends, people I had like beers with, you know, like people I know very well. So it was so, and at the same time, my family in Tel Aviv is under rocket. So it was very, it was the first time I would say, and I've been through, you know, many different types of wars and intifadas. It was the first time I ever felt existential fear, like for real. Like for real, this is something. And, you know, 24 hours pass And then I get a text message from a friend of mine at Harvard. It was a link to like a Google Doc. And she was like, look at what's circulating around. And I open it and I see the what later became the draft for the infamous student letter. The student letter that 34 student organizations at Harvard signed. Letter basically blaming Israel for everything, for the massacre, saying it's all because of the apartheid state, taking basically supporting Hamas.
Was the draft different from the final?
No, it was terrible.
From the get-go.
And I couldn't believe it, right? And I couldn't believe it not because, and I was researching this. And even when this happened, because of the shock and grief, I couldn't imagine that people can go to these lows. But what happened for me is that the moment I saw this, I was like, oh, we're in shock and grieving. They're already working. Like they're already, you know, their playbook is running. And while we're like, you know, sitting here and like, I remember I was writing to my professors at Harvard and I tried to like, and this is, you know, how people at the beginning were like, this is like 5-9-11, 7-9-11s, and the number. So I remember I was editing my letters, like at the beginning was like, this is like 5-9-11s. An hour later, I'm like, this is like 8-9-11s.
Just because the number kept piling up. Yeah.
And I realized, okay, we need to act. Like there's not room for me now to be sad. So I was like, I'm going back. I, you know, changed my flight, went back to Harvard. And first thing is that we gathered all the Israelis at Harvard that we could. We met at a house of one of our friends. We're like 60 people crammed in a living room. And the dean of the Harvard Kennedy School at the time requested to come speak with us. And by this time, the letter was already out. You know, the whole world was talking about how Harvard students are supporting Hamas. And what we told Harvard leadership at the time, this is the dean of the Kennedy School. We said, listen, we don't want you to stand for Israel. That's not what we need. We don't need that. We don't want you to take a side. We want you to say that you condemn terrorism, and we want you to condemn this letter that is dragging Harvard's name through the mud. That's all.
So I would say a relatively simple request.
Relatively simple. And right. Of course, you know, later what happened is that they put out their first response that was signed by Claudine Gay and all the other deans, a response that was a disgrace, just like a generic, bland, like, we are against war, like both sides-ism, yeah. All lives mattering, the situation. I was very close to leaving school. I called my father and I was like, what am I doing here? This place is a disgrace. Like I was so proud to come here and now I feel ashamed. Like, what am I doing part of this institution? I want to come home. And he told me, you have nothing to do here. What are you going to be, another soldier? Like, what are you going to do? Be with your parents at home? Like, there's enough people who can do what you can do in Israel. There's not enough people who can do what you can do at Harvard. And your role is there. You'll come back to Israel eventually. Stay at Harvard. Get your education. Like, stand up for your people. Be a voice there. And I was like, okay.
That is, I'm getting chills because that's exactly what my dad said about Colombia.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about going back and he said, well, I'm sure your miluim, your reserve duty is in the U.S.
Yeah.
So what did you start doing?
Well, thankfully I had some really thoughtful professors who were able to be fine with the fact that I missed most of my classes that semester. I was just, you know, organizing the Israelis on campus, doing interviews, going to protests, advocating. I went to a lot of events on campus to try and, you know, it became like this thing. Every time I saw a talk about the conflict anywhere on campus, I would just go there just because I knew it would be problematic. And I was like, I'll just ask a question. I'll talk to people. Like even this like useless, like emptying the ocean with a spoon type of And, you know, social media, I do some social media, but it wasn't like my thing where I found myself. I think I found myself more in like, I remember talking to a classmate of mine. This was after I was so exhausted. And I was like, I don't know what am I doing? How can I help? What's my role? And she's like, oh, it's very clear to me what your role is. And I was like, oh, tell me. And she was like, you're the spokesperson of the Israelis at Harvard. I was like, that's what you've done in the past. That's what you're doing now. And so just be our spokesperson. I was like, okay. And so I did a lot. And thankfully, there were a lot of people, you know, at Harvard who became very active, like Shabbos, who we both know, but also other people. But I have to say that what happened to me is that after the first semester, I immediately, semester over, went back to Israel. Now, this is not to brag. I do not get sick. I have not been sick for like 15 years.
If you were bragging, that would be a very weird thing to brag about.
Never had COVID, never have a fever. Landed in Israel in December 2023 after this terrible semester. And Shai, I was sick for 7 days. I was in bed. I could not move. My body completely collapsed. Completely. And after that event, I realized, okay, I need to rethink what I'm doing here. And I really changed my strategy. And I realized that, you know, I could, for me, like this advocacy and being a spokesperson was important, but it was, I couldn't do it as a marathon. I was like, I need to change what I'm doing. And I was lucky enough to go on a really interesting Harvard course that was a visit to Saudi Arabia and the UAE in January of 2024. And it changed my whole perspective. And I realized talking to people from the Middle East, having really difficult conversations with them about Israel and the war. But when I was in the room with like senior officials from Saudi, from the UAE, from the US, representing Israel, I realized, oh, this is what I need to do at Harvard. What I need to do is be part of this system if I can find a place to make a change and try to bring a more nuanced, more like sensible approach, because like I'm sure you can also attest to this. Not everyone is an anti-Semite and not everyone is like majority are not. The problem is that the small minority are very loud and the large majority are either confused, you know, don't want to get in, you know, don't want to like risk themselves and just like lack spaces where they can engage with this thoughtfully. And, you know, we talked about this. At the core, I'm an educator. That's what I've done most of my life. I work with people. I educate. I teach. And so I decided, okay, instead of like fighting, which was for me not the right approach, okay, so I'll focus more on relationships and teaching and content. And that's what I started doing. And so and you know, I wanted to quit Harvard. I'm still there, 2.5 years later.
So, you know, so you so in a way, you shifted from fighting the problem to searching for the solution.
Yeah, and staying in the institution that I never intended to be part of. Yeah.
And how has that been? Has it been successful? What have been the obstacles? Before we get to the next stage, like while you were still a student, what worked for you? What didn't work?
So what worked was the allies that I found. So I was able to find a few allies. First of all, the Israelis around me and the Jewish community, but not only. We made a really interesting decision. So, you know, iTrek, this organization that sends Jewish and non-Jewish students to Israel. So in 2024, there were almost no treks because, you know, no one's going to the war. Me and my friends, we said, no, we're going to do a delegation from Harvard to Israel. This is March 2024. And usually, I think on a normal year, like 200 students go to Harvard, from Harvard to Israel. We were able to bring 20 people. Like, it was so difficult. But these were 20 people, non-Israeli, mostly non-Jewish, who came for a week and saw everything. And we didn't we showed them everything. We went to the Gaza border. We went to East Jerusalem. We couldn't go to the West Bank, but we went to East Jerusalem. We met everyone. We saw all the perspectives. And we built relationships. And finally, I wasn't just talking with my Israeli and Jewish peers. I was talking with people outside the bubble who found connection to this. And the other thing is the professor that I still work with today, Professor Tariq Masood, who is the faculty chair of the Middle East Initiative, where I'm now working as a research fellow and building an Israel program as part of the Middle East Initiative. He was a true supporter because he represented this simple idea that Israel is part of the Middle East, if you like it or not. And if you're an Arab, Jew, Muslim, Christian, doesn't matter. Like, Israel is part of the Middle East. So are Palestinians. So is Syria. So is Saudi Arabia. And if we want to actually find a way to allow the Middle East to prosper. Like, if that's actually your interest, you want the region to prosper, like Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, says, I want the Middle East to be the new Europe. Like, if that's actually what you want, then you don't fight Israel. You work with Israel, even if you don't like them. And together with him and other people who are other like-minded, we were able to do a series of amazing events, bringing people from all the spectrum, promote a more nuanced, like, level-headed conversation at Harvard. And, you know, the idea, I think, it's like draining a swamp. It's really hard to, like, combat anti-Semitism very directly or anti-Israel sentiment. It's more possible to create a culture. And once you create a culture where, like, people, this is a space where Israel is a legitimate place for legitimate conversations, then the people who are on the fringes, who they realize, okay, this is not a place where we can do a lot of work, because this, they understand, okay, this is a space that it's legitimate. We'll go to a different space where no one's trying to really make Israel a legitimate part of the conversation.
I mean, it's fighting for many, many years, and we know now, and the Red Green Alliance really documented this, there was a slow and persistent effort to delegitimize Israel, right? In a conversation with Andrew Peston, he told me, like, the goal of BDS votes on random campuses is not to boycott Israel. Nobody cares, but it's to put a question mark next to the word Israel. And what you're doing is the opposite. Like, if you're going to try to delegitimize Israel, we're going to show how Israel is legitimate. And it's unfortunate that not many countries, or maybe no other country, has to do this.
Yeah. But, well, let me tell you something about Harvard. Like, how the Harvard Kennedy School, okay, one of the leading schools for government in the world, has a surprisingly high number of Israeli students, because Israelis, they want to study abroad. They invest their time and money and, you know, resource into it. So you come to the Harvard Kennedy School, almost 10% of my program, which was over 200 people, were Israelis, okay? So there's a lot of Israelis at the Kennedy School, but there's not enough Israel. And what do I mean? There's not an Israel program. There's not enough research being done on Israel. Everyone's talking about Israel. There's events all the time. Like, it's a hot button issue. Mm. Almost every class can become a discussion about Israel.
Yeah. Also for the bad part, right?
Yeah.
Because it's such a focus on Israel.
But there's actually a lack of study and research and framework about Israel. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing now, because together with Tariq Masood, we were like, okay, we actually should create, like, a serious foundation so that people can actually study about Israel in a serious way and not just go to the, you know, the topic of the what's on the news and now there's an event with someone come. That's not serious. You don't need Harvard for that. You don't need Harvard to have, like, hot button events. You need Harvard to be a place where people from all over the world can discuss the complicated issues, use their smart brains, and come up with good solutions. Because, you know, what the universities have become is that instead of exporting solutions to the Middle East, they're importing the Middle East conflict into the U.S. Mm-hmm. And that is not the role of academia in the U.S. The role of the higher education is to be a foundation of democracy, enlightenment, to bring the good ideas. While we're fighting in the Middle East and making mistakes and killing each other, hopefully places like Harvard, like Columbia, can dedicate their intelligence and resources to solving these issues. And instead, they were just importing it into the U.S. What's the purpose in that?
So everything you say is right, you know, on paper. Ideally, Columbia should be the place like that. Harvard should be a place like that. Berkeley and all the other universities. Yeah. But we know it isn't. Mm-hmm. And you and I are also in a group of Israeli academics across North America and some in Europe. Why isn't it the case that it's a place to export solutions rather than import problems?
So this is a whole another interview. Like, why is it like this? You know, it's, I think at the root, there's a few issues that are important to talk about here. One, in many ways, universities have lost their role in society. They have become, and maybe have always been, financial institutions where they're operating like a business, and not, I think now, after these 2 years, a lot of universities are waking up to their role in society. And it's not just about, you know, keeping the calm. You know, the way Harvard responded to October 7th, why was the response so bad? Because they were trying to take out a fire when the whole building was already, you know, burning all the way. They didn't realize the situation. They didn't realize you have the fire hose and you're using it to take out like a small bush, but you need to like rethink your whole institution. So I think one thing is that they don't understand their role. And the other is that it's a deeper issue for America, right? America has a role in the world. You know, I was born in this country. I am proudly an Israeli American. I have belief in the American people and the American ideals. But once you sort of, I think, lose confidence in those ideals and you sort of pull back, even in America's foreign relations, but also you pull back culturally and you start to not believe that, yes, American ideals are something that, you know, we should aspire to. That's how you open yourself to foreign influence. You open yourself to a lot of really dangerous ideas from this, like, pluralism that allows decay in a way. And what you and I think saw was this, the rise of this like sort of dichotomic oppressor oppressed ideal that really doesn't create a lot of gray, because
it doesn't allow for gray zone. Yeah, it's all black and white.
And obviously there is oppression and there is oppressors and oppressed in the world, but it's not black and white. And there's a lot of difference and complicated histories. What I believe is that if America wants to be great again, if you're on the right or the left, doesn't matter. The universities have such an important, you know, people are not going to study in other countries. Like, people on the East are, Americans are not going to other countries to study there. People in other countries are coming to study in the USA. Boston is, you know, the highest number of universities, academia per capita in the world. This has been built for centuries in the making. It would be unwise to like unravel this project so quickly. This is the value of the power of the United States, is the research, is the minds. And by the way, Jews had a really important part in shaping the culture of argument. Is something that Jews brought into these universities, you know. And I don't see myself as like a classic academic, right? But I believe that in order to make a change, some people need to leave the institutions and fight them, and some people need to stay inside and try and change. Will I be wrong? Maybe.
I hope not.
Yeah.
So you're not just a researcher and an educator. I've recently learned, I did not know this about you, but you also edit quite many volumes of different things. I want to ask you just about two of them.
Yeah.
What is Zionism 2025?
Oh, so this is a recent paper. It's called The Peoplehood Papers. It's edited by Shlomi Ravid, who's an expert in Jewish education and Jewish peoplehood. And I've known him for many years, and he asked me to co-edit with him and with Amitai Freiman a new issue about sort of the future of Zionism. You know, there is something that I want to claim, that is, there is the word Zionism and the word in Hebrew, Tzionut. It's the same word. They don't have the same meaning.
Not the same associations, right?
And I think it doesn't have the same association to a level that it's become a different word almost. Mm. Tzionut is action. It's on the simplistic level, it's just being a patriot. It's just loving your country. But it's something that's connected to our actual lives. Zionism has evolved into this very abstract idea almost, with a lot of negative connotations, obviously. But, you know, even if I put the negative connotations aside, I think the Jewish people have to have a conversation. What is the future of Zionism? And after these 2 years, the deep crisis that Israelis and Jews around the world find themselves, What is the goal of Zionism? Because if it's just to have a strong and sovereign state for the Jews in the land of, you know, our ancestors, okay, you know, mission accomplished. We were even now tested, the biggest test we could have had. We're still here. We're still surviving. But what is the deeper idea of it? And how does it connect to Jews around the world? You know, what is their project? Are they just supposed to be cheerleaders for the Israeli state? Or do they have a deeper role? So what we did in this collection is that we reached out to over 20 like brilliant leaders from all over the world. And we told them, like, give us a short article of what is your vision? Like, where is Zionism going? Where do you see it? And don't give us the cliches. Like, go try and really, like, think like Herzl. Like, try and be bold. And obviously, we got, like, very contradicting ideas. But the idea is to have a conversation and to present these ideas because, again, I think that's the most Jewish response
to
the crisis.
So what have you learned editing this this volume?
Well, I think the main themes that I'm seeing is one, there's a lot of rethinking about the role of the diaspora with Israel. You know, I think that for many years there was a very clear deal between Israel and world Jews. Israel will supply pride and, you know, a shelter if you need it and, you know, a homeland, and world Jews will give political lobby and money. And, you know, won't get involved in our issues too much and the same. And this deal held up for many, many years. But there were a lot of problems created. If I look at world Jewry, one of the major problems is that Israel actually became too central to the American Jewish identity. Israel became from a project that the, you know, American Jews supported before the founding, it became the main tenet of identity. And that is a problem because the state of Israel, while it's extremely important for us, it's not the only part of Judaism, and it also doesn't need to be the central part, which doesn't diminish its importance. And that's, I think, what's hard for Israelis, because Israelis want to be in the center. They want everyone to don't want everyone to obsess about us, but we also sort of do.
Well, I think if I push back on this, Israel became the defining feature, for many Jews in the U.S., both in their love or their hate.
Yeah.
Right? So an anti-Zionist Jew, you know, you see this a lot. The only thing Jewish about them is their anti-Zionist. Yeah. Like, I'm broad strokes, and there are some that aren't, but, you know, they identify as anti-Zionist Jew.
Yeah.
Whereas for other Jews on the other side, it's the Zionist Jews, and mm-hmm. everything about their Judaism is just the fact that they're Israeli, or that they support Israel.
Yeah.
Right? And it can't be, it's too much pressure for one small state.
Yeah, it's also too much pressure. And also, let's look at the other side. It's not as the Israelis are centering American Jews in their life the same way that American Jews are centering Israel, right? There is so much ignorance in Israel about American Jewish life. Israelis are not thinking about American Jews, about their experiences, as much as American Jews are thinking about Israel. And not that I think that the solution is American Jews think about Israel less. I think the solution is thinking about what is reciprocity. You know, we live in a time where we have these two amazing Jewish centers, right? We have a Jewish center in Israel, and we have a Jewish center in the U.S. This is amazing. We should embrace this, but we should think about what it means. What it means not only to be an American Jew who supports Israel, what does it mean to be an American Jew today? In America, what does it mean to be Jewish in America and in the challenges that America is facing, right? Because, by the way, I believe that there's no Israel without America, but I also think that there's no America without Israel. I think the two, and not only for Jews, right? I think America needs Israel. I think Israel, in many ways, is a deep embodiment of the American value, of the American story. Like, I think that there's a kinship, not because of, like, Middle East interest in politics, but because there's something about the story, about this pioneering.
Yeah, you've even written an article that's titled, "There's Nothing More American Than Israel."
Yes.
Right.
Which is, by the way, it's like flipping criticism, because this is actually a tweet that I took from Al Jazeera in a series of articles that they were criticizing the American-Israel relationship. Mm. And they tweeted, "There's nothing more American-Israel." I saw it, I was like, yeah. I agree.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. It's like when someone screams at me, you know, dirty Zionist. I'm saying, well, I'm not dirty, but
yeah.
I agree.
I don't remember when I showered. Yeah.
Or maybe I am. I don't know. To be specific. There's another volume you edited and you brought about. It's coming out now, I guess, just the past few days.
Yeah.
Class of 95, a literary anthology of the assassination of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. What's the story?
So I mentioned this before. The Yitzhak Rabin assassination, it really affected me because my parents came back to Israel because Rabin was in power, hoping for peace. And I was 10 years old when he was assassinated. And I sort of, my growing up in Israel is parallel to Israel trying to deal with this assassination. And I really think that Rabin's assassination is a before and after event, right? There's Israel before the assassination and everything that happens after. The issue is that Rabin's assassination was not just an Israeli event. It was a Jewish event of monumentous, like, Jewish history, where a Jewish citizen kills a Jewish leader. This is an, like, biblical level event that changed us, and by the way, had a deep effect on American Jewry at the time as well. I grew up doing a lot of work around Rabin Memorial, so I was spokesperson for Hanor Oved. I was also spokesperson for the Rabin National Memorial Rally for a few years. And on one of the years, in addition to sort of the ceremony, I wanted to do a different event. And I was into poetry at the time. And I was like, hey, maybe let's do a poetry evening and like somewhere in Tel Aviv about Rabin, democracy. It's such a big event. There's probably so much written about it. And then I went to search. And like, there was nothing. This is about 12 years ago. I was like, no one wrote any poetry. There's a lot of op-eds. There's a lot of articles. But there's no poetry, no literature about this event. So we put out, you know, a call for poems. And we were swamped with dozens of poems that were, you know, waiting in the drawers. So we realized, oh, this is bigger than an evening. This should be a book. And we put out the first book in 2013. It's in Hebrew, it was called Machzor 95, that has a double meaning. So it also means class of 95, like, you know, like a yearbook, because we are the generation that 1995 shaped us. But it's also like a Machzor Tefillah, you know, a prayer cycle, because if we want to remember this event, we have to create a ritual, right? So if you want to deal with memory, you can't just do it through articles and your mind. You have to do it through your heart. The reason we tell the Pesach story for thousands of years is because it's a story with heart. We remember it. The reason we remember a tragedy like, you know, Chorban Beit HaMikdash, it's not because of like the op-eds that were written at the time, if they were writing op-eds in like the Jerusalem old time, I don't know.
The Red Sea Post.
Yeah, it's more about the biblical stories, the poems, the songs, the culture. What worried me is that Rabin assassination, there was no culture around this. And this is such a deep tear in Israeli society. And if you really want to understand Israel and you want to deal with this trauma and create a space for healing and turn this event into, which was the failure of our democracy, right? We, you know, for most of Jewish history, we were not sovereign. Jews do not know how to be sovereign. We are relearning Jewish sovereignty. And we're not always that great at it. Rabin's assassination was the biggest failure of Jewish sovereignty. It was like, we can't get through our differences. And we also see that the memory is fading. And so the reason that we put out this book now, it's a translation to English, because I wanted to bring these poems. These are 40 poems of amazing Israeli poets who, from all perspectives, deal with this issue. And I wanted to bring it to an American audience. I wanted Americans to be able to talk about this, because in reality, for so many people, maybe our age, who were like conscious when Rabin was assassinated, if you go talk to like people, they have experiences from it, but it's tucked down. They don't have the tools to talk about it.
Right.
The younger generation, most of them don't know who Rabin was and can't turn this event into like a symbol of growth and democracy.
And this is true both if you agreed with his political mission or you
100%
just agreed with the
political
mission.
And there's people here who totally don't agree with Rabin's.
Right. It's the idea of if we want to keep this going, this the Jewish sovereignty going,
yeah,
then we have to, you know, we have to do something
exactly
to remember our failures.
Yes.
I do want to read, I have it here, one second, one poem from this, you know, obviously I'm biased, but this is a poem by Nitzan Mintz, who was a guest with Ted a Band-Aid on the podcast, and it's translated by Jordan Greenspan, who is also a guest here, and also happens to be my wife. And it's called, It's the Wound's Birthday. It's the wound's birthday. We'll throw it a party. We'll tie balloons for the wound. Wish for it to grow. We'll make sacrifices to the wound so that it may be hallowed. And the Hebrews, I want to read it
as
well.
Yes, go for it.
יום הולדת לפצע, נעשה לו מסיבה, בלונים נקשר לפצע. נאחל לו שיגדל, קורבנות נקריב לפצע, יתגדל ויתקדש. And the reason I wanted to read the Hebrew, because even people that don't understand Hebrew, those last two words, they really evoke something.
And I love this poem so much because Rabin's death is a petza, is a wound in the Israeli psyche, in the Jewish soul, in my opinion, you know, and, but there's something about like, you know, let's celebrate this wound. Let's center it. Let's like, and return to it. So it will be something holy and not just a trauma.
Right. So Class of 95, where can people find this book, by the way?
They can either go to my website, theclassof95.com, or search for it on Amazon. They are pretty good at shipping everywhere in the world. So
amazing. So I have so many more questions, and we'll have to do this again. And this is becoming a theme of this podcast.
Yeah, for sure.
Again, but I do want to end with the Here I Am lightning round, a series of rapid fire questions.
Okay.
There's no right or wrong answers. Whatever comes to mind first. Barak Sela,
yes.
What is one thing people don't know about you?
I know how to play violin.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That the Jews... Wow, one thing that people don't know about the Jews. I think people know this, but we invented comic books.
All right. What is your favorite curse?
Zeinbein.
I'm not going to translate that one. You'll have to Google Zeinbein. When was the last time you cried?
This morning.
If you could have any Jewish person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, dead or living, who would that be?
I want to say Yitzhak Rabin, but honestly, it would probably be I'll go with Yitzhak Rabin. Why not? I have some questions to ask him.
Okay. What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
Hands down, Hanukkah.
What is your least favorite Jewish holiday?
I don't want to be a hater, but I would say my least is Purim.
Mine too, don't worry. When do you feel safest?
When I'm in Tel Aviv.
When do you feel least safe?
When I'm in Tel Aviv.
I get that. What gives you hope?
My nephews and niece.
How old are they?
Youngest is almost 4, I think. Oldest is 13.
Nice.
And music also gives me hope. Somehow, no matter how like bad the world is, somehow people still make good music. So that's hope, you know?
Somehow
someone is making really good music.
As long as musicians, you know, keep their mouth shut about things they don't understand.
I mean, there's enough musicians and there's a lot of bad music, but somewhere someone is making really amazing music, no matter how like bad the world is.
Yeah.
You know?
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
So I'm biased, but I would I really would encourage people to Google Hanor Oved Velomed in Israel, the youth movement that I grew up in, who are doing amazing work. You know, they worked with the evacuated families during the war, and they do work with like the most difficult and challenging youth groups in Israel, and are doing and are building the backbone of leadership in Israel for Jews and Arabs.
Can you spell that for people?
So they can Google either Dror Israel or either...
So Dror is D-R-O-R.
D-R-O-R space Israel. Or if they search for Noal, it's N-O-A-L. Both amazing organizations. And in general, support the youth movements in Israel. People don't talk about this enough. The youth movements in Israel are Israel's secret weapon. It's the secret weapon of the startup nation. It's where our leaders are being shaped and born, and we really need to support them. And so I really encourage people to look into it and find the youth movement that they like and uplift them.
All right. Barak, where can people find you?
They can find me on Instagram, BKSELLA, or barakselah.com.
And when you go on your website, you can also see that you give, you have at least 4 different talks about Jewish peoplehood, yeah. U.S.-Israel relations,
yeah.
about everything that we've talked about and more. So I'm hoping that more and more people will want to hear what you have to say. I'm glad we made this work.
Yes,
I am
I'm
so happy.
Happy.
This is almost like, you know, if you believe in fate, then this is fate.
The best things happen by accident.
If you believe in accidents, then this is a amazing accident. And I'm just glad to say, here I am with Barak Sela.
So, darabha, Shai. It was an honor.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."